"Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind.
So we're going to see a picture of Wally. And Wally's not usually this easy to find, is he? In the Where's Wally puzzle books, Wally usually stands in plain sight, and you have to try and find him. But it's not that easy because the scene is usually in utter chaos, with so much going on all over the place. So here's a scene from one of the books of Where's Wally? And in this railway station scene, I included this especially for Chris Elson. And in this railway scene, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. There are cows escaping from the trains. There are train loads being tipped over, dogs biting passengers, kids climbing all over the luggage, conductors chasing stowaways. There's a car stuck at the crossing. There's a suitcase tipping over. People are stumbling out of trains, presumably not minding the gap. And even a train driving off the rails. It's just manic chaos. Busy, 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 busy. Stuff just going on all over the show. People running around. There's just stuff happening everywhere. This evening's passage would make a really good scene for Where's Wally? There is so much stuff going on and everything looks so totally out of control. Jesus is being arrested. And there is just so much chaos going on around him. I have the book here, so if you want to look for Wally afterwards, you can have a look. It kind of makes you wonder and ask, what is going on here in Mark 14? Is Jesus still in control? Are things actually going according to plan? Isn't everything just falling apart? Because it looks like nothing is happening as it should. Since Mark 11, when Jesus entered Jerusalem, we've been looking at the last week before Jesus' death, and everything is pointing to the cross. Everything that is going on here has a distinctive cross shape about it. Jesus is in control, marching to the cross on his terms, according to God's plan, despite how it looks, despite all the chaos going on around him. It's important that we see that there are no mistakes. There is no plan B. Jesus is going to the cross to bring about God's kingdom by dying as a ransom for the many. In the last week, he's taught the disciples the sad news that he is going to die, but that he'll be victoriously raised to life again. He tells them the horrifying news that he'll be betrayed by one of them and that they will all abandon him. After the Last Supper, Jesus walks the disciples to Gethsemane to pray. And we see Jesus' fear of the cross as he asks his heavenly Father for another way. And he fears far more than just the incredible physical pain, but the agony of carrying the sins of the world, of the whole world, and receiving all his Father's holy wrath magnified onto him like one giant magnifying glass, magnifying the sins of the whole world onto him. and it terrifies him. We see that Jesus is deeply troubled and distressed. He tells his disciples that he's overwhelmed to the point of death. He's overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. His heart is literally so broken that he nearly dies before getting to the cross. And by the end of his prayers, he submits, as he always would, to his Father's will. And he is ready 100% for what lies ahead. Look at verse 41 in Mark chapter 14. Halfway through, "Enough," Jesus says to his disciples. "The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hand of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Notice all the exclamation marks in there. "Enough," one. "Rise," two. "Let us go," three. "Here comes my betrayer," four. They all capture Jesus' fierce, renewed determination to fulfill his Father's will. And we'll see more of his resolute determination in our passage this evening. But here's the first thing I want us to see this evening. I want us to see that chaos surrounds Jesus through the sinful people around him. In these 10 verses, only two of them actually describe something that Jesus does. The rest all paint a picture about those around him. And it's not a pretty picture. The picture we get of those around him is horrible. It contains some of the worst traits of humanity: betrayal, scheming, injustice, and abandonment. And right from the start, right from verse 43, we see some of the scheming. Take a look at verse 43. "Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders." We know that the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders have been out to get Jesus since the start of his ministry. They were always more worried about coming up with a plan to kill him than actually listening to his words. In Mark 3, just after Jesus heals the man with the deformed hand, we read, "Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." Turn to Mark chapter 11, verse 18. It's on page 716 in the Blue Church Bibles. Mark 11, verse 18. This is after Jesus clears the temple and he speaks out against these Jewish authorities. "The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him. For they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching." Take a look at Mark chapter 12, verse 12, in the next column. "They looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away." The Jewish authorities, that's the teachers of the law, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the chief priests, the elders, and the Herodians. They're all scheming against Jesus. They're all out to get him. A group that seldom saw eye to eye, working together. The enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of stuff. Working together, conniving and plotting to arrest and kill Jesus. But it's not so simple, because the crowds love Jesus. So they can't just go up to Jesus and arrest him. They need to be devious. So they plot. And so they scheme. They need to be careful, because they don't want to cause unrest and start a riot amongst those that follow Jesus. And then the perfect opportunity falls into their laps. Take a look at chapter 14, verse 10. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this, and they promised to give him money. So Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Of course they're delighted. They've been scheming since the start of Jesus' ministry. Of course they're delighted. Now they have a man on the inside. A man watching and waiting for the perfect opportunity to arrest Jesus without creating a riot. So Judas watches Jesus' every move and waits for the perfect opportunity. The other Gospels tell us that Judas leaves the Last Supper early. Maybe it's that he goes out to fetch the authorities and brings them to the upper room. But when he gets there, he finds Jesus and the disciples gone. But that's not a problem because Judas knows where they are. He takes the armed crowd with him to Gethsemane. And we mustn't think that the clubs mentioned here are a sign that this is some random motley crew that's been hastily gathered together to arrest Jesus. But these are professional temple guards and peacekeepers. And we're told by historians that the typical Jewish weapon of the day was a club. You see, this crowd that comes out to arrest Jesus is sanctioned, authorized, and sent by the Jewish authorities, the highest Jewish court. They've been sent legally to arrest Jesus in a carefully crafted plan. We see more evidence of their scheming in Jesus' response to the timing of the arrest. Take a look at verse 49. Jesus says, "Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." You see, they had plenty of opportunities to arrest Jesus. Jesus is saying to them, "Why didn't you arrest me then? I was with you every day, teaching in the open in the temple. And here you come with a guard, armed to the teeth, under the cover of night, to arrest me." In all the chaos that's going on around Jesus, people are conniving and scheming against him. But we also see one of the worst kinds of evil: betrayal. I'm sure many of us know the deep hurt of betrayal, at least at some kind of level. When you think someone is your trusted friend, to only find out that they've really been plotting behind your back. They've been pretending to be nice and won your trust. But really, they're actually your greatest enemy. Not only out to see you fail or fall, but to see you hurt. And they want to inflict as much pain as possible. And all the while, enjoying themselves. See, this gives us some idea of what's going on here as Judas betrays Jesus. We're told in chapter 3 that Jesus went up onto a mountainside to appoint his 12 apostles. And he called to him those he wanted. He called to him those he wanted. One of those was Judas. He looked Judas in the eye and said, I want you. The one he wanted. The one he wanted by his side. The one he ate with. The one he walked with. The one who's heard all his teaching. The one who has seen him do all these amazing miracles. Jesus wanted him. He's the one that would betray Jesus. It's the worst kind of evil. Verse 44 tells us the plan. A kiss is a sign of friendship, of personal relationship. But Judas arranges it as a method of betrayal. He wants it to hurt. He wants it to hurt Jesus bad. And notice Mark's contempt for Judas by calling him the betrayer. Verse 44. "Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. 'The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard.'" just before Easter in 2011, Lady Gaga released a song called Judas. Most people have either never heard of it or have long forgotten it. I fall into the category of never heard it. But forever, Judas, one of the 12, will be remembered as an illustration of betrayal. And rightfully so. And the plan wasn't just to arrest Jesus, but to humiliate him by taking him away under God. You see, Judas knew Jesus wasn't going to try and escape. Maybe he feared that the other disciples would have offered some resistance. But I suspect that he wants to hurt Jesus further by rubbing salt into the deep wound of betrayal. Take a look at verse 45. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. Going at once. He goes to Jesus without any hesitation. He greets Jesus warmly, "Rabbi," and kisses him. The original Greek tells us that this wasn't just a peck on the cheek, but a long, meaningful kiss. At weddings, we cheer the first kiss of a newly married couple. It's the highlight for many guests at the wedding to hear the words, "You may kiss your bride," and to see the loved up couple kiss for the first time. Yesterday, we couldn't leave the house until Harry kissed Meghan. It's a beautiful picture of intimate love. The newspapers call it kistery. It's the kiss that changed the monarchy, they claim, and brought it up to date. It's sweet, but really? It's this kiss in the Garden of Gethsemane 2,000 years ago that really changed history. It was the start of the single most important event in human history, period. A kiss in all cultures all around the world is seen as a sign of friendship and of love. It says, "I care for you, value you, love you." But Judas turns it into a weapon of mass destruction. And it must have hurt Jesus big time. Verse 46. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Am I leading a rebellion? Am I leading a rebellion that you come out after me with swords and clubs? Am I leading a rebellion that you need to fight back and defend me?" And here we see the gross injustice of it all. Jesus hasn't done anything wrong. He hasn't committed any crimes against the Jewish authorities. He hasn't committed any crimes against the ruling Roman authorities. But here he's arrested despite his innocence. They come with an armed crowd to arrest an innocent man who was always going to cooperate. It's like they're taking out a bazooka. Or I'm told in the UK the World War II version is called a PIAT. It stands for Projector Infantry Anti-Tank. It's like taking out one of these heavy anti-tank weapons to take out a pesky snail. The snail may deserve it for killing your roses, but Jesus is innocent. This armed guard is just a little bit OTT. It's just a little bit, quite a lot actually, over the top. We all hate to see injustice. If we see something we don't agree with, we're quick to shout, "Unfair!" We're so good at spotting injustice because it offends our deep sense of what's right and what's wrong. From the child crying in the corner because they haven't had a turn with their favorite toy. We were at the park yesterday and poor Tyron wanted to go on one of those little spinny cup things. And these two girls were on it the whole time. And poor Tyron just stood there, just totally deflated. Unfair. Or a teenager that's been treated unfairly by his friends, crying in his bedroom. Been treated horribly for no reason. Parents, we see that and we go, unfair. Or maybe an adult losing out on a job that they are totally justified in getting, but somebody else gets it who's way, way less qualified than what they are. Unfair. Chaos surrounds Jesus through the sinful people around him. We see it in the scheming of the Jewish authorities. We see it in the betrayal of Judas and in the injustice of his arrest. And lastly, we see it in the way Jesus is abandoned. As Jesus walked to the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples, he quotes Zechariah 13, "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." Well, in verse 50, we see it come to reality. And in verse 51 and 52, we see the extent of that abandonment. Read with me in verse 50. "Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind." There's a lot of discussion amongst biblical scholars as to who this young man is. Who he is isn't really the point. The point is, he ran away. You don't need to turn there, but it could be a reference to Amos 2, verse 16, where it says, "Even the bravest warriors will flee naked on that day, declares the Lord." The commentaries tell us that the word used for young man in the original Greek refers to an exceptionally strong, valiant, faithful warrior. And it's this brave, strong, faithful warrior, young man wearing nothing but a linen garment that was following Jesus. But when this valiant, strong, faithful young man is seized, he runs away naked, leaving his garment behind. The point is that someone who took the time to follow Jesus, to follow what was going on, is scattered like sheep. You see, he would rather feel the shame of his nakedness than stand with Jesus. They grab him, but he shakes free and he legs it, naked, just to get away. Tragically, Jesus' words have come true. The disciples that said they were willing to die for him, they can't even stay awake for him in the garden. And now instead of dying for him, they scatter like rats when a light goes on. The disciples scatter just like Jesus said they would, like a rat when the light goes on. Jesus is surrounded as he is arrested by the chaos of sin. In a moment, we're going to see Jesus as a contrast to all this chaos. But here, we see the horror of human sinfulness. The worst of the worst, rampant disregard for Jesus, everyone trying to take things into their own way and ignoring God. But this tragic picture is a picture of the world today. Sin in us and all around us, tainting our thoughts, tainting our actions and tainting our words, hurting us and hurting others. Now there is no denying that there is good in people. But how much of what we hear on the news is good news? And it's not just that bad news sells, but there is just so much bad news and so little good news. I'm kind of sorry if this is depressing, but it's the truth. There is chaos all around us, and there is chaos in us. Maybe you're still doubting. Be honest and ask yourself, what is easier to do? What is easier to do? To put yourself first or others? Don't we as parents, or perhaps you were a parent a while ago, can remember, don't we as parents often make decisions based on what's easier for us rather than what's best for our children, even though we love them? It's our default reaction to shout and get angry at idiot drivers for cutting us off. We don't ever think, oh, great, now they can get to work on time. It's easier to make excuses and whine than listening to our parents and doing what they ask. What we see here in Mark, the rest of the Bible makes very, very, very clear. We are all sinners. And we do all fall short of the glory of God. We don't live God's ways. One of the clearest examples is in Romans 3. We get to turn there. Romans chapter 3. It's on page 794. Romans chapter 3, verse 10. And notice just how total and comprehensive the rebellion is. Paul says to his Roman readers, there is no one righteous, not even one. And the way to understand that is that he's saying, not even me, and not even you. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. And the way of peace, they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And so we see the worst of humanity in the chaos surrounding Jesus, surrounding his arrest. But in contrast, we see that Jesus is the worthy king. And Jesus is the worthy king because he is in control of the situation. In verse 42, it's Jesus who gets up to face the mob with his arrest warrant. He doesn't try and run away or hide because things are happening as scheduled. And Jesus at any time could have called upon legions of angels to fight for him. But he doesn't. With a single command, just by saying the words, he could have destroyed his enemies. But he doesn't. He doesn't because things are going according to the divine plan. This arrest is not a mistake. With all the chaos that's going on around him, just like in the Where's Wally books, with all that chaos going on around him, Jesus is calm. Jesus is in control. He speaks two calm sentences. Verse 48. Am I leading a rebellion, said Jesus, that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled. So tensions are high and there's a lot of drama going on here. And one of those with Jesus, John tells us that it's Peter. He draws his sword and clumsily tries to defend Jesus. His aim is hopelessly off and he chops off poor Malchus's ear. Luke tells us that among all this chaos that's going on, Jesus heals the man. Even with everything that's going on, Jesus heals Malchus's ear. Jesus is calm. Jesus is in control. His last miracle is to heal his enemy. Gracious and good is Jesus. See, Jesus is so different to those around him. He's focused only on achieving the Father's plan. The scriptures must be fulfilled. And it's his only concern here. He is not concerned about the chaos itself, but concerned about those causing the chaos. Enough to heal one of those arresting him, and enough to go to the cross for them. You see, the tragedy is the cross. The tragedy is our sin. But the beauty shines through all this chaos. And the beauty is seen in the willingness of King Jesus to go to the cross despite of and because of the sin and the chaos. You see, most times when somebody hurts us, we're quite happy to hurt them back or to let them suffer. It's human sinful nature to laugh and enjoy it when the reckless driver cuts us off, overtaking in the slow lane, and then see that they're pulled over by the cops. We do enjoy it, don't we? Is it just me? Jesus is hurt by those around him. But instead of fighting them, he fights for them. And it's the very reason he goes to the cross. He dies on the cross for such as these and for such as us. My favorite Bible verse captures this so well. I'll read it out. 1 Peter 3, verse 18. Christ died for sins, once and for all. The righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. You see, this, to quote somebody from yesterday, this is the power of love. The righteous, innocent Jesus dying on the cross for the unrighteous. For the unrighteous people like you and me that love scheming, that love betrayal and injustice and abandonment more than we love Jesus. Among all this chaos going around Jesus, he is in control and he chooses the cross. If you love Jesus, then we can rejoice in him as we sing, "Praise my soul, the King of heaven." If not, if you don't love and trust Jesus, why not? See, one day you will face God's wrath. And remember, it's real. God's wrath is real. It terrified Jesus. And he faced God's wrath on the cross so that we don't have to.